You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP Northampton, 103.3 FM, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Also in the studio here with me is Dwayne. Thanks for coming in, Dwayne.
My pleasure. Faithful listening audience, good afternoon.
Today's show is going to be on... Oh, I was supposed to start off the show with this.
Make poop. Everybody in the club wanna make poop. Everybody in their car wanna make poop. Everybody going on a date, make poop. Everybody running late, just make poop. When you're dodging traffic cause you gotta take a dump, no matter how good you drive, you'll always hit a bump. But you will get home now sooner or later, but cross your fingers that you have toilet paper.
So this show is gonna be about composting toilets and human urine buckets, how to deal with pee. So I have an interview with Jim Zimmerman from the wastewater treatment plant. I have an interview with Adele Franks, who's on the Grow Food Northampton board and got the composting toilet at the Florence Community Gardens installed. And I have a phone interview with Abe from the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro, and they're talking about their urine collection project. And if I have time, we'll play something from Russ Massey about, well, unrelated, about leaf raking and blowers and the joys of raking leaves.
If you're in luck.
Well, I'm going to start here with this interview with Jim Zimmerman from the wastewater treatment plant. Jim is a chief operator there at the plant. So I interviewed him just to kind of get a sense of, well, here it is.
Say a bit about what's involved in all this sewage that comes through the pipes down here to the wastewater treatment plant.
Pretty much whether you're washing your dishes or your hands, taking a shower, flushing the toilet, the water just kind of disappears. And a lot of people don't understand where it goes. It goes down to our collection system, where there's a series of pipes that will bring it down here to the treatment plant, where we can have it come by gravity. We'll utilize gravity to get it down here on occasion, because of the lay of the land and such. We'll need a pump station to pump it up at certain locations so that we can utilize gravity again. When it comes down to the treatment plant, it comes into what we call our headworks, where we remove what are called the grit and the rags. Grit is sand, stone, coffee grounds. Actually, rice and corn show up in there too. And then the rags can be, you know, all kinds of different things. It's amazing the things people flush down and send down the drain. Once it's gone through that and we've removed as much of the grit and rags as we can, it goes out to our primary tanks, where there's a little more settling that occurs and it's a clearer water that's coming off. That water is sent to what's known as our aeration basins, where it's mixed with solids from the bottom of our secondary clarifiers, and which has a amount of bacteria in it, and the bacteria treat what's called the primary effluent that's coming off the primary clarifiers. They consider that as food, and they will throw a little oxygen in there with them. They're happy, they're eating, they're breaking down the wastes. It goes from our aeration basins back to the secondary clarifiers, where it's all slowed down and allowed to settle out. The difference between what comes in and what goes out from the secondaries is amazing. In fact, what comes into the plant is very grayish, murky looking. What goes out of the secondary tanks, if you put it into a glass, like a regular drinking glass, and set it there next to a glass of tap water, you'd be hard-pressed to be able to tell that it was a difference.
Yeah, I actually looked online at the YouTube video that NCTV did. They did like a 5-minute tour of the sewage treatment plant, and they had a picture of the three, like the what it looks like when it first comes in, and like in the middle of the stage, and then like the totally clear stuff. Okay, so then what happens to the clear stuff?
Well, then the clear stuff basically goes out to what is called our chlorine contact basins, and it's dosed with a little chlorine. That way any pathogens, which are harmful bacteria, are pretty much taken out. I mean, obviously you can't kill 100% of anything without harming the environment. So there are levels that are set up by EPA for us to reach certain disinfection levels before we can discharge it to the Connecticut River. And out there, basically it's mixing in with all the other water that's coming down the Connecticut, traveling all the way down to Long Island Sound eventually. Mm-hmm. But we have one test that we do twice a year where we take a sample of the river water up above where we discharge, and we take our effluent, and it goes down to a lab. They take various dilutions of our effluent, and they put organisms in it. And they also do the same for the Connecticut River water. They put organisms in that. And then over a period of 48 hours, they do a count on how many of those organisms die. Uh-huh. And the goal of the test is, it's called the LC50, so you try not to have more than 50% of the organisms die. To date, 100% of our effluent has not killed an organism. Uh-huh. So it's pretty clean that's going out there.
And then what happens to what's remaining in the tanks, like the sludge or whatever?
Well, the sludge is collected into what we call our gravity thickeners. So part of that is whatever sludge that's in the primary tanks. And then also a certain percentage of the sludge that's in the secondary tanks are combined in the gravity thickeners, and then they're sent over to our dewatering building where they're dosed with a chemical called potassium permanganate to sort of, it's an oxidizer, and it sort of sweetens up the smell of it a little. Mm-hmm. And a polymer, which helps to create what we call flock, and so that makes the solids bunch up into clumps. And then that's delivered up to our belt filter press, and as it goes down the belt filter press, at the very top of it, a lot of water comes out by gravity, and then after that, it goes through a series of rolls that squeeze it out. So we'll have solids going in at that belt filter press at, say, 4%, and coming out, we'll have 20 to 24% coming out.
Of solid, and the other percentage is liquid, or what?
It's, yeah. I'm trying to think of a good comparison.
Really dry brownies.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, we do call it a sludge cake, actually, but it's coming off the press.
Sludge brownie, okay.
Yeah.
And you said that you sweeten it up with that oxidizer thing, too. So.
Yeah, well, makes it...
brown.
So, and then it goes from there, it's put into, I think they're 30-yard boxes, and we send tons of that down to Waterbury, Connecticut, where they incinerate it.
How many, like, it goes down there on a truck? Like, how many truckloads a week or a month or day or...?
We're generally averaging about 4 loads a week. Okay. And that would be roughly about 20 tons in a load. Okay. A number of years back, one of our biggest contributors is the Coca-Cola plant over in Industrial Drive. And we had a lot more solids would build up. And a lot of that was because of the sugars that were coming down to us. Uh-huh. Because, of course, the bugs love sugar, just like people love sugar. Uh-huh. And if they have that as their source of food, they pig right out on it. Uh-huh. But they've put in a pretreatment system, so they're taking out a lot of the material that was in there before. They've actually got their own system where they're dewatering solids and such, and that's being land applied over in Hadley, I believe. But it's dropped dramatically the amount of solids we have to deal with. We used to have... Uh-huh. Okay. 7 or 8 loads a week that would go out, and now we're down to like 4.
Wow, that's interesting. So they're just taking care of it themselves separately.
Yeah, they're taking care of a lot of it themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Anything else you want to say?
Just people need to be aware of what's going down the drain. Obviously, you know, if you're putting cooking grease down the drain, that's going to cause issues, because even though it's hot when it's first going down the drain, as it cools, it clings to the sides of the pipe and it will cause blockages. A number of wipes that are out there, like baby wipes and stuff like that, manufacturers put on them, they're flushable. The data we've seen, though, shows that most of that stuff does not degrade. It has, in some instances, caused clogs in pipe work and in pumps, which can cause an accidental release, actually, at times. You know, if you get enough material that builds up and backs everything up, it's got to go someplace. And if it can't get down the line to us, it's going to cause an issue.
Do you have any thoughts on composting toilets or urine diversion? Have you heard of the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro? They're doing a urine collection project and then, like, treating it and applying it to, or, like, I don't know, storing it in some way and testing it and then applying it to hay fields.
I know there's a lot of different things that are going on. A lot of research is going on. Any way that you can do anything different that's cost effective and still getting a maximum amount of treatment and being able to reuse it is a wonderful thing. I know there is, like especially out in the Southwest, they do a lot of the wastewater. They leave a certain amount of material in there, and they actually put it on lawns and crops out there because there's still nitrogen and phosphorus in the water, and they're good components for growth and stuff like that.
Right.
So they're utilizing that. There's some places where they're actually injecting sludge into fields. Obviously, you know, the sludge has to be of a high enough quality where you don't have metals
right.
and stuff like that in it. So EPA takes a lot of pains to make sure that what's going out there is going to be safe for the environment and that they only allow so much of it out there at a time. Mm-hmm. There are facilities that actually take the solids and they compost it and pelletize it and sell that as a soil amendment. Uh-huh. And I know there's research going on where they're determining if there are a certain type of bacteria that might actually be able to utilize the waste in the water and generate energy. So there's a lot of research going on. And in recent years, some people have actually looked at taking the components in the wastewater and trying to recover some of the materials out of it, you know, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, a variety of metals if you can. So that's kind of where everything is sort of headed right now.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your time.
You're quite welcome.
That was Jim Zimmerman from the Northampton Wastewater Treatment Plant. Jim's been there since 1989, he said. He's the chief of operations there. A really friendly guy. He said if you want a tour of the wastewater treatment plant, give them a call. They give tours. Next, I'm going to talk about more like on-site ways to deal with poop and pee. Though it was actually funny, when I got there to interview Jim, he was in the bathroom, and so I guess he was dealing with his poop on site.
He really knows his...
or whatever he was doing. Yeah, he knows his business.
Yes, he does.
So the next interview I have is with Adele Franks from the Florence Organic Gardens, the Florence Community Gardens. Adele is on the board of Grow Food and has been involved with preserving that land since the beginning and was instrumental. It was like her project to get the composting toilet installed at the garden for all the gardeners.
That's pretty nice.
It's nice. So it used to be my favorite bathroom in town was the one in the basement of City Hall. It's all like sturdy. It's really nice. But times have changed. And now my favorite bathroom is the composting toilet at the Fog at the Florence Organic Gardens. So I'm here with Adele Franks, who was instrumental in getting this composting toilet. Actually, I'm going to call it an outhouse. She was instrumental in getting it installed. I'll call it an outhouse because it is an actual house. It's like a house here in the field. So I'm wondering, Adele, for people who've never been here, never seen it, can we just start with a description of what this facility is like?
Well, we call it the sweetest, most beautiful outhouse in Massachusetts, and I think that's true, unless somebody someday proves me wrong. We built it because we did not want to have to rely on the porta-potties that community gardens often rely on.
Oh, yeah, I remember when I first started coming here, there was a porta-potty over there, and the smell didn't really fit in.
Well, it was pretty horrible. I hated it. Everybody hated it. The neighbors hated it. They immediately complained to the city about how what an eyesore it was. Anyway, we all hated the smell and everything else about it. And you might remember we grew flowering vines over it to try to make it look more attractive, but it really didn't work very well.
The smell is just like so chemically.
It's chemical, total chemical, and it's really hot in there in the summertime when the sun's beating down on it. You can, like, one time I had to use it, I could barely sit on the toilet seat. It was scorching hot. Anyway, we knew that wasn't going to last, so we've tried to figure out what to do, and because of the constraints of the site, there weren't a whole lot of options, but we knew we wanted to do a composting toilet for the educational value of it. And because of the constraints of the site, we couldn't really do a conventional composting toilet. So we consulted with some experts in the field. We have a local expert. A lot of people know Ben Goldberg. He knows a lot about high-tech and low-tech composting toilets. Mm-hmm. And he, in collaboration with the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro, Vermont, which is doing a lot of cutting-edge research on composting both urine and feces, they designed this system for us, which is very low tech and which fits in very nicely with the garden. We didn't have to do any kind of major construction. And then once we had kind of the internal design finished, then we thought about, well, what kind of a structure do we want to build around it? And I just felt like it was really important that we have a beautiful, sturdy structure around it that would make it very, very pleasant to use. So we invested quite a bit of money and time, and Ben Goldberg built us this really beautiful little building. We made it large enough so that it could accommodate a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's much larger than most outhouses. We haven't yet built a ramp for a wheelchair. That'll come in the future. So it's large, it's airy, it's spacious.
It's about 6 feet by 8 feet. I'd say I was just kind of arm lengthening it out.
Yeah, I would say at least that big. And we have a solar panel donated by the solar store in Greenfield that powers our exhaust fan. Mm-hmm. And we have a little wind turbine on top of the exhaust pipe also that prevents any rainwater from coming into the actual bin that contains the poop. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very pleasant little place, I would have to say.
Yeah, the outside is kind of like wooden,
rough-hewn lumber.
It looks a lot like the tool shed, the other structure in the garden, the other main structure in the gardens. So it fits in nicely with that. It's got a metal roof with, like Adele said, the solar panel and the exhaust twirly gig.
It was important to us that it looked very much very similar to the existing shed. We really wanted some continuity on the site. So that was a big debate because it would have been less expensive to build a shed roof instead of the gabled roof. But we went with the gabled roof so that it would look like the existing shed.
Mm-hmm. Can we go inside? Can you give me a tour of the inside?
Oh, I'd be delighted.
So we should say that you have to have special privileges to get inside.
Yeah, there's a programmed lock on the door, so you have to know the secret code to get in, and all the gardeners here at the garden know the code. So come on into the most beautiful outhouse in Massachusetts.
It smells kind of like wood.
Well, there's a lot of wood here. Yeah, it kind of feels like a cabin to me. And you can hear both the exhaust fan running and the wind turbine turning. That's the only sound in here. We have a urinal for people who like to stand up and pee, and it's actually a recycled 2 or 3 gallon water jug that's been cut and carefully assembled to function as a urinal, and it is piped so it goes directly to our urine tank.
And then the toilet seat and lid, can you describe that?
Yeah, so we have a state-of-the-art urine-separating toilet seat, which the front part is configured so that we're Urine usually falls. It is carried away by a pipe to our urine tank. And then the back part is an open area where poop normally falls directly into our poop bin, which is underneath the bench.
So how does a person use this when they got to go? What do they do?
Well, first they put the code, the special code in the door so they can open the door. And then they come in, and if they want to use the toilet seat, they open the toilet seat, and they sit down just like normally on a toilet. And if they know they want to take a poop, they better just make sure that they're sitting all the way back so the poop falls through the hole in the back. It's usually pretty intuitive and not something you really have to think a whole lot about. So it functions just like a regular toilet seat.
And then after they take a poop, then what?
Well, then they can wipe their butt with this very handily located toilet paper. And then they can take a scoop of wood shavings and put that into the toilet.
The toilet paper dispensers.
I would say it's a piece of a trunk of a tree with its branches holding the toilet paper.
Yeah, better said. And then there's also some paper towels if you need that are on the tines of a pitchfork that are safely capped off the points.
And I want to point out a design feature. If you notice how artistically Ben made these cross pieces on the roof, they're curved in different ways. They're quite lovely.
Yeah.
It's also, this is a vented roof, so there's some airflow up, and there's screening all the way around so that we can discourage insects and little critters from getting in here.
So you poop in the toilet, it goes in this collection bin, then what happens?
Well, then after a bit, we empty the bin into a larger receptacle, and in accordance with Massachusetts regulations for composting toilets, that material, which consists mostly of wood shavings and poop and toilet paper, once that larger structure is filled, that gets sequestered for 2 years so that it can compost.
So right now, the larger structure, it's like a 65 or 95-gallon toter with a lid?
It kind of looks like a trash dumpster.
Okay. Or a big trash can.
It's specially configured to allow air to circulate throughout it, so it will aerobically compost. Mm-hmm.
It's got some plastic pipes that go through with holes.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then
after it's sequestered for 2 years, according to Massachusetts regulations, the material needs to be placed under 6 inches of soil. So our plan is to dig a trench about a foot deep somewhere along our hedgerow, put the material there, cover it with 6 inches of soil, and then it will function as a soil amendment for our hedgerow.
When you say sequestered, you mean it just sits in that toter for a couple years? Or what do you mean by sequestered?
Yes, I think the definition of sequestered is separated in a secure fashion from the ground, from groundwater, from any possible contamination. So in our case, that would mean remaining in the special dumpster that we have specially configured for that purpose.
So who empties it from underneath the toilet seat into that toter thing?
Well, in the past it's been me, and this year we've got a whole team of very enthusiastic volunteers who are really eager to help do maintenance on our outhouse, and I feel confident that this year I'm going to have a lot of help.
So how often have you had to empty it in the past?
Every couple of weeks.
Every couple of weeks, okay. And then the toter, what kind of volumes are we talking about? Like when did this composting toilet get installed, and how much volume has been created since it was put here?
Well, this is the start of our third year. The first year, of course, it wasn't installed at the very beginning of the gardening season, but pretty close. So I would say we've been going about 2 years. And we have not yet filled up the little dumpster, in part because the material, of course, shrinks down as it's composting. The volume decreases.
I was taking a glance at the regulations today, and they said that the material shrinks to 10% of its original size over the 2 years that it's sequestered.
Yeah, I would say that's about right. That's certainly our experience. So it's not nearly full. And I'm expecting that it will be full probably by the middle of this summer, And so we'll have it, Ben is making us another bin right now so that it'll be ready when we need it. So at that point, we will, you know, put a label on it that says 2015, and then we'll wait until 2017 before we bury it under 6 inches of soil.
Mm-hmm. So what about the pea? It goes into the collection tank, and then what happens?
Well, in previous years, we donated the urine to the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro, Vermont, where they're doing really exciting research with urine. Most people don't realize that there's a lot of nitrogen and a lot of phosphorus in urine, and those are exactly the kinds of things that plants need to grow, and it's the kind of thing that people go out and buy fertilizer to put on their gardens is, you know, nitrogen and phosphorus. And urine already has it. And, you know, the other part of that story is that the commercial fertilizers, often the nitrogen is produced in a factory with fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And phosphorus is mined, and the earth is actually starting to run out of phosphorus. So doesn't it make sense to use urine instead, which is free and readily available mm-hmm. as a fertilizer? So the Rich Earth Institute is actually doing research on that very thing. They're using urine to fertilize hay fields and very carefully measuring the output of the hay fields in conjunction with some other agencies that are doing this research. So we donated our urine to them because it was such a worthy purpose, mm-hmm. and they need a lot of urine. This year, I think their goal is to get 6,000 gallons of urine, mm-hmm. and we only generate about 200 gallons through a summer. We may get more this year because, of course, we have more gardeners this year. Mm-hmm. But this year, you know, that was a temporary solution to donate our urine to Brattleboro because Brattleboro is not exactly around the corner.
And it's upriver, upstream.
So this year, with permission from the health department, we're doing a pilot project to compost our urine with some carbonaceous material right here on site. And we're still in conversation with people with more experience in these matters about what exactly is the right substrate to use to mix the urine with in order to get a really rich, wonderful compost. And it'll probably be a combination of some shredded maple leaves and some kind of woody material, either wood shavings or planer shavings, something to help keep the leaves from adding down. But people seem to think that leaves are really the best in terms of producing a really good compost. And we'll probably augment that. We'll probably put in some soil and some things that have some good microbes to get some good composting going. But the idea is that once we get a really good compost, a really nice composted product from our urine composter, our plan is to use that again on our hedgerow as a soil amendment and then cover that with wood chips, as currently we have that that area covered with wood chips. So it would, even though we would consider it to be perfectly safe, just to be ultra, ultra conservative, it would never come in contact with food. Mm-hmm.
When you say the hedgerow, do you mean the brambles, the berries, or what?
No, along Meadow Street, we have a very long hedgerow of nut trees. We have some berry bushes in there. There's a variety. There's a variety of trees and shrubs. Okay. Eventually, it's going to be large enough to help to break this incredible wind that is almost always blowing across the garden site. So, maybe not in my lifetime, but future gardeners will enjoy the break from the wind.
So when you're emptying the pooper into the toter, or when you're emptying the urine, when you're pumping urine from the tank into carryable containers, what can you say about the smell?
Well, urine... first of all, when urine sits around a while, it's worth mentioning that although there are very few pathogens in urine to start out with, pretty well gets sterilized if it sits around long enough in a closed container because of the pH. And there's a whole science about time and temperature to assure that there are no pathogens in the urine. But the urine smells. It is not a pleasant smell. And so what I learned, when I went to Brattleboro a couple of weeks ago for the urine drive kickoff event for the Rich Earth Institute. And Abe announced that he'd been experimenting and has discovered that if you add white vinegar, and a certain proportion to the urine in the collection tank, it does not smell.
I have to interrupt Adele right here and say that Abe later clarified that you got to add the vinegar first when the tank is empty, because it kind of smelled when we added it after the tank was full. But yeah, add the vinegar first, then you can piss.
And so I'm very excited about that. And in fact, I brought a gallon of white vinegar with me today because I'm going to pour it into the tank. And then when we pump it, we'll see whether or not, there's no smell.
Did Abe have a theory on what the chemical processes are, what's going on there?
Abe had a lot to say about that. And if you want to hear that, you can talk to Abe, because I'm sure that I will mangle the science of that. It was very interesting. But yes, he had quite an explanation about not only why it cut down on the smell, it's because it basically, there's a chemical reaction. So instead of producing ammonia, urea is the result. So it's the ammonia that makes the horrible smell, apparently. Mm-hmm. He also said that it's actually more beneficial to plants in that form. So it's kind of a double benefit.
So is it more acidic?
Said that the because of the proportion of vinegar to urine, it doesn't really change the pH that much.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we step outside, and I want to ask you a little bit about the permitting process or working with the Board of Health or the state regulations, how that was. So you've made this a very upfront, legal kind of thing. It's a really public, obvious thing. So what have you had to do to get it, or what's that process been like?
Well, you fill out a permit application with the health department here in Northampton. And then once you get a permit to actually build the structure, then you get an inspection before you're ready to actually start using it. So we had an inspection, and our health inspector gave us the thumbs up, and we were all set to go. It was painless, and we actually changed the design shortly after we opened, and so we notified Daniel Washick, who was our health inspector, that we had changed the design somewhat, and he gave the okay to that, and we've been up and running ever since.
So last year you took the peat up to Rich Earth, and now it's being composted on site. How was that process, getting approval on the design and all for that? Because I know when I was looking at the regulations today online, the state DEP regulations, there was no mention of urine or how to deal with urine that I saw.
Yeah, the state regulations were written before we had source-separated urine facilities or capabilities. So these urine-separating toilet seats are relatively new here. I mean, they've been using them in Scandinavia for longer. But so our existing regulations really don't address source-separated urine, and all they deal with is liquid exudate from composting toilet, which, of course, is contaminated with feces. So it's a kind of a regulatory dead end. There are no regulations about source-separated urine, and we hope someday that will be changed. But in the meantime, because what we're doing is such a low-risk proposition, and we're doing it so carefully, and we really don't have a large volume of urine, and we are guaranteeing that it will not contaminate the groundwater because of the way we have it set up, we were able to get from our Board of Health here in Northampton a permit to construct, I'm trying to remember the name of it, I think it's a disposal system construction permit, something like that. Our hope is that once we can show that this is a beneficial use of urine, and it diverts urine from septic systems and from sewage treatment plants, both of which are problematic because septic systems leach nitrogen and phosphorus into the groundwater, and then that works its way towards streams, lakes, rivers, oceans, causes all sorts of problems, creating algae blooms that are harmful to the ecological system and to human health. And sewage treatment plants, of course, are expensive to operate and, you know, have to spend a great deal of resources to remove the nitrogen and the phosphorus, whereas nitrogen and phosphorus are actually beneficial resources that can be used. So our hope is that once we've demonstrated a feasible way to make a good use of this human resource, that we will lessen the burden on the environment, and it will become something that more and more people can do safely, and that the and that we will develop appropriate regulations to guide people along in this process. But right now, you know, we're far from that, but we're taking a baby step in that direction.
I really appreciate the work you've done to have this here and give us such a nice place for people to pee and poop. That was Adele Franks of Grow Food Northampton and the Florence Organic Gardens. Adele got the composting toilet installed at the Florence Community Gardens on Meadow Street. So the composting toilet at the community gardens is kind of like a fancy setup, right? But it doesn't have to be that fancy. There's many different ways that you can do it, and it can be really low-tech. And it also doesn't have to be in areas that have a lot of space. This is my housemate, Barry. I'm talking with him.
There's this awesome woman, Nance Clem, in Chicago, who does a lot of really cool permaculture and composting projects. But one project she did a few years back was called Humble Pile. And she collected humanure from a number of her friends, all by bike trailer, and proceeded to compost it for 2 years, and then returned finished compost that was tested and safe to all of her friends that she had collected it from.
And this was just like in her backyard in the middle of Chicago, or where did she do it?
It was an undisclosed location.
But in the city?
I believe so.
All right. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP, Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. You can also listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/Ruthie. If you just tuned in, we've been talking about composting toilets and things. Poop. Yes, poop. Here, have a song. Fred Meyer.
Poop, poop, poop in a bucket, yeah. Let's all poop in a bucket. Poop, poop, poop in a bucket, yeah. And we'll save the world. There's 6,610,229,137 people on the planet. And when you gotta go, you gotta go. It's a fact of life, dagnabbit. And where it goes, we don't know. Why should we care at all? The latest scoop in Poop Town is the biz of City Hall. But cleaning poopy water takes a lot of juice. A little pool of fossil fuel for every party use.
Swoosh.
Then we the people get it back. Tastes like bleach. In a pinch and stink the stitch. This I don't capiche. So I poop, poop, poop in a bucket. Yeah, let's all poop in a bucket. Poop, poop, poop in a bucket. Yeah, and we'll save the world. Consciousness, and then polar caps would stop melting, the economy would be fair, the air would smell of roses, we'd have health and we'd have care, and we the people would love each other with food for one and all. They'd grow a garden and poop down and one at City Hall. So let's poop, poop, poop in a bucket, yeah. Let's all poop in a bucket. Poop, poop, poop in a bucket, yeah. And we'll save the world. And we'll save the world. And we'll save the world. Let's all poop in a bucket, yeah.
That was Fred Meyer, Poop in a Bucket. And
you got to love that tuba. Right on cue.
And the Human Urine Handbook, I got to give a shout out to the Human Urine Handbook.
It's by Joseph Jenkins.
It talks about how you can poop in a bucket in a safe and effective way. Also, the state, the MassDEP regulations about composting toilets, which you can find online, are a good guide. Ben Goldberg is a local, he lives in Leverett now, I believe, but he's a local composting toilet installer. If you want to go the more formal route, he installs Phoenix composting toilets. Dwayne, tell us something that's going on in the area.
Okay, Saturday, May 2nd, 2015, the 34th annual No Hold Pride Parade, an all-day event that will be held rain or shine. The annual gathering is traditionally held the first Saturday of May as a national kickoff for the LGBT celebrations throughout the country. As many as 20,000 people with diverse identities will gather to march from downtown Northampton to the three-county fairgrounds. Entertainers and speakers will be on stage throughout the afternoon, and dozens of vendors will be on hand to sell their wares and ideas. Performers include Christine Martucci, a nationally known folk and rock artist from Asbury Park, New Jersey, the Pioneer Valley Gay Men's Chorus, and the Raging Grannies. So there's that one on Saturday.
It'll be a good time.
This Saturday again. Balloons, all everywhere balloons.
There'll be lots of color and lots of smiling faces. It's a great time. And I think there's going to be a drum contingent in, like a recycled bucket drum contingent in a bike trailer, I've heard.
Oh, no.
So, what else? You got something
this
else?
This one here, our friend Pocky dropped off. It's a film showing in panel on May 6th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Academy of Music. It's called The Hand That Feeds. Sometimes you have to make your own justice. Shy sandwich maker Mahoma Lopez sets out to end elusive conditions at a popular New York restaurant chain. The epic power struggle that ensues a single city block into a battlefield in America's new wage wars. The award-winning new documentary about immigration, fast food, and making your own justice. It's a feature panel with the filmmakers, an Occupy Wall Street activist, and food system workers. There's no mention of any kind of admission on this one, but I'm sure that you can call the Academy of Music in Northampton, the box office, and they'll let you know.
Thanks, Dwayne.
My pleasure.
Every day in the electronic media, people talk, or more likely yell, about politics.
We do things differently.
Our job is to talk about the things that we hope will be of interest to you without all the shouting and anger.
We hope to provide facts and have reasonable discussions about the issues of the day.
That is to disagree without being disagreeable.
Join us every Friday at 7 p.m. for Civil Politics here on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton or anytime online at civilpoliticsradio.wordpress.com.
Hi, this is Eva Capelli. Let's get nice and toasty. Jamming with me here every Friday from 12 to 1 p.m. on the Toast and Jam Cafe. Right here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM or valleyfreeradio.org.
A man is like a pair of shoes, gotta try him on for size. You're looking at stilettos, but then you compromise. Cause there's something about the comfort.
You've been listening to Out There, and the next interview I have is with Abe Noah Hayes from the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro. This was a phone interview because he's in Brattleboro and I'm in Florence.
I'm Abe Noah Hayes. I'm the research director of the Rich Earth Institute. We're based in Brattleboro. We operate the first in the nation urine collection and reuse program in the Brattleboro area in Vermont. And so what we're doing is we're improving water quality and creating fertilizer at the same time. We have about 170 participants who have various systems from toilets to standalone waterless urinals that they use to collect urine. And then we transport that to farms where we sanitize it and make it ready to be used as a fertilizer. and then it becomes a sustainably, locally produced fertilizer, mostly for hay farms. The problem we're trying to address, that we're trying to solve, is that currently if you flush your toilet into a sewer system, then the urine that you flush away has a huge amount of phosphorus and nitrogen in it, both of which are pollutants when they get into rivers. And a lot of sewer plants around here aren't capable of removing those nutrients. So they go right through the sewer plant and become pollution in the river, which then has an impact on the river or even a greater impact on Long Island Sound. So we're stopping that from happening by getting urine out of the sewer, and instead of letting the phosphorus and nitrogen be pollutants in the water, we are turning them into fertilizer to use on land, because they're a fertilizer the whole time. It's just that we don't want to be fertilizing our rivers. We want to be fertilizing our farms. Mm-hmm. So that's what we try to do, and we are the first ones in the country to do this on a large scale. People all over the country do it in their own gardens, and we hear a lot about how people do that, but we're the first ones to do it on a community scale. Uh-huh. And so we've been receiving some support from the USDA, because it's promising as a fertilizer, and also from the EPA, because it's also promising as a way to improve quality of watersheds and the waterways in them.
So, like, how many gallons of urine are you dealing with at this time?
We have a goal this year to collect 6,000 gallons of urine, and mm-hmm. I think we'll make it. We collected over 4,000 last year, so that's our yearly haul. But, of course, if it were done on a large scale across the state, for instance, we've got a little over 500,000 people, and you figure everyone produces over 100 gallons of urine, so that would be, what, about 50 million gallons of urine produced just in the state of Vermont each year. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of urine to deal with, but it's also a lot of fertilizer potential. So we see this as a growth industry for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Does most of your urine just come from Brattleboro, or how far does it come, and how is it collected, transported?
It comes from, I wouldn't know exactly how far, because it's up to individual urine donors to decide, how far they want to bring it. Of course, we don't encourage people to drive long distances to bring us the urine, because it's like driving your recycling across the state. It just wouldn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people have business to do in Brattleboro, so they'll come from all over the county, and they'll bring their urine container when they come to Brattleboro and pump it out at the depot, and then take it home again. And okay. Then from there, we take it to the farms.
Cool. I've heard you've done some research on how things like antibiotics and hormones and maybe prescription drugs, like how do those things, like when you put that on the land, do plants take them up, or what are they broken down, or what happens to those things in urine?
Well, a large portion of drugs and medicines that people take do pass through into their urine. And currently, when you flush that into a sewer, it also passes right through the sewer treatment plant, because the plants that we have now for treating wastewater were never designed to remove pharmaceuticals. So there's a lot of concern about pharmaceuticals being essentially dumped directly into the river by means of our sewers. So by capturing that urine and putting it onto biologically active soil, there's actually the potential to do a much better job at breaking down and eliminating those compounds from the environment. So we're doing a two-year study with the University of Michigan and the University of Buffalo, looking at the fate of pharmaceuticals in urine when it's used agriculturally. So we're looking at the levels of pharmaceuticals in urine, and then the levels that we can detect after we've used urine as a fertilizer in the soil, in the soil water, and in the plant tissues of crops that we harvest. And we don't have our final results yet. It's a two-year study, and we only have preliminary results. Mm-hmm. So we're waiting to have the final ones before we announce what we actually found. But our hypothesis is that there's going to be significant biodegradation of these compounds by the soil ecosystem.
And of course,
our hope is that we'll find that this is an effective way to deal with this issue of pharmaceuticals. What we do have our eye on, though, is particularly whether there are significant levels of any of these compounds in the plant tissues. Because if there are, then we'd have to look at, well, what would we maybe have to do to pre-treat the urine before we use it? I think there's no question that urine is an effective fertilizer and can be an environmentally and human health safe fertilizer. What we're mm-hmm. trying to answer is there anything that we should do to the urine before we add it to the soil to deal with pharmaceuticals, or is the soil capable of breaking them down on its own?
You have read that if you're going to use your own urine on your own garden, it is good to dilute it like one part urine to, I don't know, 10 parts water or something like that.
We've done some studies on dilution of urine when we use it as a fertilizer on hay. And we found that diluting it by a factor of 1 to 1, if there's any positive effect of dilution, we see it by the time we've diluted it half and half with water.
Oh,
so
great.
The 3 parts of water to 1 part of urine didn't give us any noticeable improvement. For a garden, I have heard guidelines or suggestions, really, that diluting with water is recommended. That's not something that we've studied in terms of dilution rates for fertilizing garden plants. But
I have to interrupt right here. I clipped something out of the interview that I said, which was about diluting your urine a whole lot, and that would that be like a waste of water, kind of counteracting the whole, well, part of the purpose of trying to save water. And so Abe is responding to that in the next thing he says.
You said that if you were to dilute it with water, you'd sort of counteract the effect of water conservation by saving urine, but we water our gardens pretty often anyway. Either the rain is watering it, which is an effective way to dilute urine. One thing we've been thinking about is what about timing our applications to hayfields before a rainstorm? Uh-huh. It's a little bit hard to get a farmer to do a whole farm that way, but in a garden, I suppose that would be easier.
Yeah.
And we're also going to be doing some fertigation this summer of some crops where we mix the urine into the irrigation water. So that's another way to dilute it without having to use extra water to do that.
Great. Well, is there anything that people can do to be supportive of your project?
Oh, well, sure. We're always looking for more urine donors. Mm-hmm. We're also, of course, also looking for financial donors. But the nice thing about this project is that you can give according to your ability. So we have a lot of urine donors. We also have actually a good group of regular financial supporters, and yeah, between the two of those, that's what keeps our project alive. You can learn about our project at richearthinstitute.org and get involved. Tells you how to put either sort of liquid asset to work in our project. You can also sign up for our newsletter if you just want to follow what we're doing and get more informed.
Yeah, that's great. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I do want to mention what the scale is of the amount of fertilizer that's present in urine, because it's often surprising to people. The amount of urine you produce in one day is enough fertilizer to produce an entire loaf of bread. So if you picture that's the resource that we're wasting every day by flushing urine down the toilet, enough fertilizer to grow a loaf of bread, that's pretty big portion of the fertilizer requirements that we have to grow the food we eat. And also you can picture that's a pretty big nutrient load to be adding to the wastewater system, everything in a loaf of bread, in terms of all the phosphorus and potassium and nitrogen. So it's a major resource. It would replace a lot of synthetic fertilizer if we were to use urine as a resource rather than treating it as a waste. Another thing that I think is really important in terms of what motivates us and what motivates our urine donors is that this is something that we make every day, something every one of us produces. And we've all grown up and gone through life thinking of it as urine is this stuff that we need to get rid of privately, sort of secretly, and get it far away. We want to be rid of it and think of it as a dirty pollutant. And in fact, that's only because we've been mixing it with water and flushing it into rivers where it is a pollutant. But if we can harness that and use it where it's actually beneficial, then we're creating something that is the stuff of life. And I think a lot of people who try to do things to benefit the environment, myself included, often are avoiding doing things we might otherwise do, like driving, trying to drive less, even if there's a place we'd want to go today, maybe wait till tomorrow to combine a trip. The nice thing about your impact as a urine donor is it's a positive impact, and it's something that you can give back to the environment, give back to these ecosystems that support us. I think that's very very empowering and very inspiring.
Yeah, it's so simple.
Yeah, so simple. And it's so much part of who we are and what we do, how our bodies work. And it's really just a cycle that's been broken. because every animal that lives in the woods is helping to fertilize the systems that support it, and we're the only ones who are breaking that cycle and mm-hmm. taking our own bodily products and mm-hmm. trying to take them out of the picture.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, I really appreciate you taking time out of whatever you're in the middle of doing today to do this.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, I've been working on our new urine pasteurizing device. It's a very energy efficient thing that we've gotten in the permitting process of the state of Vermont. So we'll be able to take it around anywhere in the state of Vermont and pasteurize urine that people have from their own community collection processes. And then farmers will be able to use that on their fields anywhere in the state.
Oh, cool. So that will just move instead of trying to move the urine.
Yes, urine is big and heavy. And the pasteurizer will just fit on a little trailer and we can take it anywhere.
That's great. All right. Well, good luck with it, with stuff.
Oh, thank you. You know, one thing I would mention, actually, since I mentioned the pasteurizer, the reason that we pasteurize the urine in our project is because we get it from the entire community. And we also distribute it out to various farms. So we want to be cautious with how we treat it, and the state has that as a requirement of us as well. But there are guidelines that the World Health Organization distributes that were produced in Sweden based on research done there. And the finding from that research was that there wasn't a human health need to do any kind of pre-treatment sanitization if a household was using its own urine on its own gardens. Uh-huh. Because urine is really not, pure urine is not a significant disease vector. Just living in a home with the people that share your house with you is a much closer sort of contact than using the household urine as a fertilizer.
Uh-huh.
So that's the reason that we go this somewhat unusual step in terms of urine reuse of pasteurization, is that we're operating such a large project.
Mm-hmm.
You can always come up and visit us. We try to time it so that we have a bunch of folks at once to do a tour, but we always like to have an open door.
That was Abe Noyhaes from the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro, and you've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP Northampton, 103.3 FM. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Dwayne Rainey's been here in the studio today, too.
Yeah, take that, Monsanto.
And Dwayne's my DJ consultant. Here's some Brad Paisley. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. This is Ode de Toilet.
Not to buy her flowers, her big expensive gifts. She says she don't want jewelry, and she doesn't need another dress. If I want to show her how much I adore her, best way that I found is to make sure when I'm finished, I put that toilet seat down. We've been to counseling to try and see the ways we could improve this thing between us, different ways to show each other I love you. Forget about those getaway vacations to romantic coastal towns. If you want to say I love you, then put that toilet seat down.